Welcome to the second season of Operational Harmony, balancing business and mental well-being, where we achieve goals without sacrificing peace. Our host, Nikki, is the owner and founder of Nikki's Office, where she specializes in social media management, business audits, and business coaching. Her journey through mental health and entrepreneurship not only brings awareness, but also equips her with valuable coping skills. This unique experience offers a fresh perspective on approaching challenges and innovating in different ways. Let's introduce our guest.
Hey, I'm Dr. Gary Sprouse. I'm the Less Stressed Doc, and I'm a physician who's retired. But during my time in practice, I worked with a bunch of people who were really stressed out, and I came up with some new insights that I think really can help people have less stress. So I'm with Nikki now to help see if I can help you guys have less stress.
Thank you for being here. So what does it mean to you to have less stress?
Well, so what I think is that we all have coping skills, and we all have ability to handle some of the things that are going on in life. But life is continually changing. So we're never in a position where we're not having any stress. We're always in some kind of changing kind of environment. And so what I find is in this environment, more and more people are getting to the point where they're beyond their coping skills, and then they get into trouble. And so what I find is we can all use some less stress, but there are some people, and it's getting a bigger and bigger number, where they're so stressed out that they really can't cope anymore. And so they need a new way to handle what's going on. And so the insights that I bring to the table help them come off the ledge and get back on their feet so they can handle what's going on with their life.
That ledge is a slippery slope or a slippery.
Yeah, I've read a couple of books that talk about good stress versus bad stress. And I don't really buy into that. I understand what the point is, that when people are anxious, sometimes it makes them do better. And yeah, I get that. But what I want is people to do it by choice, not because they have to. Like I had a person I did a podcast with the other day, and he's a musician. And he's 40 years into his career, and he tells me that every time he gets ready to go on stage, that he's so nervous that he's ready to throw up. 40 years. I'm like, seriously, for 40 years, you've been ready to throw up every time you go on stage? And so we had some discussions on how to change that mindset so he doesn't feel like that anymore. And what we talked about was, hey, you've been doing this for 40 years. Be a scientist like I am, right? So I consider myself a scientist. It's like you've been doing the experiment for 40 years, and I guess that you're afraid you're going to fail, like things aren't going to go well, but you've had 40 years of experience saying, no, this is going to go just fine. So rely on that research and go, next time it comes up, you're like, you know what? I'm good. I've done this for 40 years. I'm good to go. I don't need to get so nervous that I puke.
Yeah, I'm not sure that I would get on stage for 40 years if I felt like I was going to puke every time.
I know, right? It tells you what kind of person. It says something about a person that's doing that, right?
I think I'd give up after the second or third time. I'd be like, hey, this is not for me. If I can't, like, not have this feeling, I ain't doing this.
You would think,
I just shake like a leaf, and you can hear it.
I've met a couple of people. Like, I had a patient once that was in the theater. And she had the same kind of reaction. She was a introvert, but when she was on stage, it was like she was a wholly different person. And on stage, she was great. And then she'd get off stage and go, oh, I can't believe I just did that. Right. So
I can't relate to that because I push myself daily to get things done. I'm not saying that I don't, but at the same time, pushing yourself so bad that you're sick or like traumatized by the experience doesn't sound like the best way to go about life.
Yep. I agree with you. That's why I gave him that advice. And when we finished the advice, he was like, oh, thanks. He goes, I'm really going to keep that in mind. And I said, like, well, good. So now I have to call him back and say, hey, did it work? I know, but you're the one who's telling me that you're pushing yourself every time you do this podcast. So kudos to you. What I find is people, and I'm sure he's in that category, there's a part of them that's nervous, anxious, worried, things aren't going to go right, whatever. But then the other part of them says, no, we're going to do this. It'll be all right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I have anxiety because new people I don't know what's going to happen. It's like a group project. You never know who's actually going to participate.
Yeah, wow. This being a fellow podcaster, here's what I say. Like when I do an interview with someone or I'm being interviewed, I feel like I'm in a dance. It's a new dance partner. Like my wife and I, when we go dancing, she knows what I'm going to do. I know what she's going to do. And we've been doing it for 13 years now, 15 years actually. And so we have it down, right? But when I'm with someone new, like in a podcast and you're doing, it's a new dance partner and you have to feel out where they're coming from and where you're coming from and match it up. And it's like, it to me, that makes it exciting. Go, hey, we can do this. And you're like, yeah.
Yeah. I've had some not so trained people on my podcast in the last couple of weeks. And so it has created very unique situations.
You're right. There is a skill set you have to have to know how long the podcast is and how to answer questions and how to give the interviewer some chances to ask questions and things like that. So, yeah.
Yeah. And there's both sides of it. So some people don't talk enough to give so that you have a chance to ask a question because I need input from you to be able to ask the question because I don't know where you're going with this. Say something. Or had people ask me a question and then stare at me through the camera like, what's next? And I'm like, yeah. I don't know. You said yes. What am I supposed to say now?
Well, I've heard interviewers on TV and they talk about some interviews are easy, some interviews are not so easy.
Yeah. And then I've had.
Wow, but isn't that the same when you go dance? I found some dance partners, they're just in the flow, and other ones are not in the flow at all, right? So.
I am not a dancer.
Well, they're together.
I am,
we're going to have to get
as white as can be.
There you go.
I am as white as can be. My spine does not move how it's supposed to move to be dancing.
I keep trying to figure out how to incorporate dance into like a seminar that I do or some kind of, if I do a speaking engagement. Like I was at some conference and they were teaching us how to be speakers. And I was like, I raised my hand. I go, well, what happens if I sing during this? And they go, what? They go, nobody's ever asked that question before. I was like, I know, but how memorable would that be, right?
Well, you can make us, they did that whole Bills song. Remember the conjunction junction? They did the Bills thing so that you could remember how bills get made.
Yeah, I mean, all the time. We use singing a lot, just not at scientific conferences. I'm like, well, why not? Why do we have to be boring?
Because science has a tendency to be more factual than fun.
You can do both. This is one of my goals is to be able to do both. In fact, where was I in California? And I had come up with this idea of, if I can't get people to come to my seminar to listen to me drone on for hours, what if I had like a show, right? Where they were singing and dancing and they got to learn something during the show, right? So I get out to California and the guy gets up to introduce this lady who's going to be doing a 1-hour Broadway show. And it's to help people learn. And she had a term for it called, I don't know, info entertainment or something. And I'm like, dang it, that was my idea. So I'm talking to my friend. He goes, Gary, calm down. There's probably room for two of you. I was like, all right, fine. I'll give you that.
So how do you help people find out their stressors? Because some people can't, like, I know that at certain points of the day, my anxiety will go through the rafters and it'll be something that I don't know what it is. Of course, I have an anxiety disorder, so that might play a part in that. But for somebody who doesn't have a mental illness, sometimes they don't understand why they're getting anxious or what it's for. Do you help with that or is that a therapy issue?
Yeah, no. So what I do, one of the things that I've learned about what I'm doing is that I give things very concrete definitions. So when people say anxiety, you go, here's what I find. Like when I say, what is anxiety? People go, what do you mean? It's just anxious. And you're like, okay, what does it mean? Where does that come from? Then you go, well, it's an emotion. You're like, I get it. So what's an emotion? And what I found is when I'm talking to even therapists and I go, tell me what an emotion is. Here's what their answer is. Well, it's like anger and fear. And I go, I hear that, but that's an example of what an emotion is. Tell me what an emotion is. And a lot of times they don't know because nobody's ever asked that question. And so as I've been going through and answering these questions based on the models that I work with. So to me, emotions, so anxiety, any of these things that we talk about, anxiety, fear, worry, they're all fear reactions. They're all some variation of fear. So then the question comes up is, what is it that you're afraid of? And so when you ask the question like that, not saying, hey, what are you anxious about? You go, what are you afraid of? And then that points them in a direction where they can more easily find the answer. So typically it's more like, and I've read this in several places, but it was brought up to a point by Tony Robbins. And he goes, there's only so many things that we're afraid of. And some things like, we're afraid of failing. We're afraid of not doing a good job. We're afraid of not having enough resources, right? Blah, blah, blah. So there's a certain amount of things that we're afraid of. So when you put them in those categories, then people can go, oh yeah, you're right. You know what? I'm worried that when I meet somebody new, it's not going to go well and I'm going to be embarrassed. And you're like, well, then that would, I'm afraid I'm going to drive over a bridge and my car is going to go out of control and I'm going to fall off the edge. But as you put it in terms of what is it you're afraid of, then people are way more likely to figure out the answer. Not always. So I see a lot of patients with panic attacks. And here's what I tell them, right? The panic attacks are the same thing as a phobia. They're the same reaction. But here's the difference. With a phobia, you go, oh, I'm afraid of heights. I'm afraid of crossing bridges. I'm afraid of whatever. You can then adjust your environment to not be in those situations. But panic attacks come from nowhere. We don't know what's causing it. So you can't adjust your environment. So now you're stuck with this horrible reaction that comes on, and you don't even know why it's coming on. And so then you feel like you have no control over the situation. And that makes people stressed out. And then they sit around going, oh, is it going to go off now? Is it going to go off now? And then that's where they start getting agoraphobic, because they're like, I don't know when this is going off. And it's embarrassing when I'm freaking out in the middle of a grocery store. So then you just go, well, I don't want to go to the grocery store. And you're like, no, 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 no. So like, I had a patient. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Like I said, I have anxiety and panic attacks. And interestingly enough, they consider me to be borderline agoraphobic, because I don't leave my house unless I absolutely have to, and it has to be like for a reason. But for me, my fear isn't that I'm going into Walmart and something bad could happen or whatever. It is more concentrated on the people. But I have learned from a lot of years in therapy, a lot of years, is that when we adjust our thinking, like if we have a phobia, let's say. So saying we have a phobia of heights can be pretty easy to say, well, I'm not going to be on heights, right? Like, I'm not climbing the house. I'm afraid of heights. You're literally, I am afraid of heights. You're not getting me on a step stool unless there's an emergency, right? So that kind of thing, cutting that kind of thing out where you can, absolutely. I'm saying you're never going to go across a bridge again when you live in a town that has two of them, and that's the only way to get out of the town. Well, now you're isolating yourself. So sometimes eliminating the phobia isn't possible. You have to work through it. And so there's that. I'm not saying what you said was wrong. I'm just saying cutting out something because of a panic attack or something only creates the thing. Now, my agoraphobia is more to the fact that I am safe at home. And when I'm here, it's like, why do I have to leave? And then I leave and I go to the grocery store, I go out to eat, I go to the doctor's appointments, and I'm perfectly fine when I do it. It's just, I want to be back home where I feel safe sooner rather than later.
You bring up, when you say the word safe, right? I'm doing a seminar and my wife's in attendance, and I do this thing with some hypnosis, no linguistic programming. And you pick a time and people have felt safe and you get them to recreate that in their mind. So I said, okay, well, find a time when you felt safe. And my wife looks at me. Now there's a group of people here, right? And she's like, I've never felt safe. And I'm like, what? I'm like, what do you mean you've never felt safe? And so after the seminar, we sat down. I'm like, hey, what does it mean to feel safe? What does that mean, right? Like, fear is like an emotion that we can talk about, but what does it mean to feel safe? And it was weird when I started sitting down because I realized I didn't have the answer to what it means to feel safe, right? So what I found was that safe, feeling safe, is actually the absence of stuff. It's the absence of fear. So it's not a thing. It's the absence of stuff. And so when I was saying to her, don't you ever feel, isn't there ever a time in your life when you're not afraid? And what she said was, in the present, yes. But when I include the future, we might be safe right now, but something might happen to you or something might come into our house. Or and I'm like, into whether you feel safe or not, well, then you could literally never feel safe because you don't know what the future is. Somewhat predictable, but not that predictable. And so mm-hmm. then you never get the opportunity to feel safe. So then I came to the conclusion is that my job is not to make people feel safe, but it's to make them handle a higher percentage of uncertainty. So if you get on a plane, do you fly at all? Yeah. I was guessing that, right?
No.
Right. Okay. So here's the answer, right? So the chance of a plane crashing or landing, let's just go with 1 in 1,000,000. It's probably less than that, but let's go with 1 in 1,000,000. So my job would be to say, hey, look, that's 1 in 1,000,000 shot. So I can't tell you that the plane's never going to crash, but it's 1 in 1,000,000. So your fear reaction should be equivalent to 1 in 1,000,000. So if you have a fear of winning the lottery, that's the same idea, mm-hmm. right? So basically, then feeling safe becomes increase the amount that you can tolerate. So one of the ways to do that is understanding the process you're going through. So I can't say to you every time you walk out of your house that you're not going to meet somebody who's going to be a jerk to you. But I can give you the skills to say, hey, I don't give you any credibility. So you're going to call me a jerk. I don't care because you have you have the credibility of an infant. So what do I care, right? Mm-hmm. So I can give you tools to protect yourself. So that you can feel safe. Or I can teach you how to do jujitsu or tai chi. So if somebody comes and tries to attack you, you now have some skills. Or I can give you some pepper spray. But now when you walk out the door, you know, there's things that could happen to me, but I feel more protected, which then makes me feel safer. So that now I can go out and not have as much fear, because fear, one of the things fear does is makes you not do stuff. So mm-hmm. when people are afraid, fear is saying to you, don't do that because that's dangerous. But if what we've done with fear is sometimes expanded what makes us describe it as dangerous becomes limiting so that you can't do things because of fear. So if someone said, stand on top of a 10 meter diving board and jump off, you're like, yeah, I don't think so. It's like in fear.
How high is meters again?
Right,
but how if it says, meters again?
Yeah, I know, right? I was just telling this story to a friend of mine. Is my son used to be on a diving team at the Naval Academy. It was a camp that they would go to, and the parents would come once a week. And he's jumping off at 10 meters, it's 30 feet in the air. He's jumping off the thing, and doing flips and everything else. And I'm like, yeah, I don't think so. So I got up to 7.5 meters, and then I'm that's enough. I was proud of myself that I got that high, but whatever. But if it's limiting you from you can't get out of your house or you can't get off your island or you can't, then no, this is too much. And now this is where I come in and go, no, we need to figure this out. And what I've done is when I go, if you understand what the issue is, then it's a lot. What I have found is when you understand what the issue is, then it's way easier to fix. It's not that it's easy, it's easier. So when I say to my patients, thinking about a panic attack, right? So a panic attack, the panic attack is actually a normal reaction that people have. It's just a giant fear response. The problem with it isn't the reaction, it's what's setting off the reaction. So if I said to you, don't sneeze, wait, what? I can't not sneeze, what the heck? If something gets in my nose and irritates it, I'm gonna sneeze. And you're like, yes, you're right. So your body's been set up to have this fear reaction, but as a sneeze, you go, okay, well, I'm gonna sneeze and then it'll be done. Or maybe I'll sneeze 5 times and that'll be done. Or I'm going to cough a few times and that'll be over. So panic attacks are the same thing. It's a normal physiological reaction. And you just have to wait because it's going to go away. So I tell people with panic attacks, think of this as a smoke alarm. So you're in your bed. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. Your smoke alarm goes off. It's going, rah, 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 and you're wake up going, ah, oh my God, what's going on? My house is burning down. And you get up and you check it out and you're like, there's no smoke. I don't see any smoke. I don't see any fire. What? Battery's not working right. So the signal got screwed up. It's not the right signal. So panic mm-hmm. attacks are like that. The signal's going off saying, you're danger, right? And you get it and you check it out. You're like, yeah, no danger here. And you're like, oh, okay. Then I can turn the alarm off. I don't need it for this situation. And then it mm-hmm. gives you some sense of control, because that's the worst. Because here's what I find, that people get panic attacks to their panic attack. So when they feel that anxiety come on, they go, oh, there's that feeling. I hate that feeling, which then sets off a fear reaction, which then just compounds the reaction. So if I say to them, look, this is just a normal physiologic reaction, like sneezing, like coughing, it's going to go away. The less energy you put into it, the less fear you put into the panic attack, the faster it goes away. And then you're going to be back to normal.
Okay.
Now, I don't know if you've tried this or not, but I got certified in hypnosis and neuro-linguistic programming. And I've done a little bit, but my instructor has been doing it for 40 years, right? I've sat there and watched him take somebody who had a really bad panic attack. And within 30 minutes, they didn't have the panic attack anymore. But there was one example they gave us. This lady had come in, and she has a fear of elevators. And he spent half an hour, 45 minutes with her. And she goes, I'll be back in a second. And half an hour later, she wasn't back. He's well, okay. And he goes to find her, and he finds her. And he goes, where were you? She goes, I was going up and down the elevator. And you're like, wait, what? Like in 30 minutes, she was like, whatever word you want to use, cured. I don't know, whatever word you want to use. But there are techniques out there that are incredibly effective.
I've heard about hypnosis. I think there was somebody else on the podcast who talked about doing that, but I don't think they went into it. But hypnosis for me, so far from the knowledge that I have, is one of those parlor tricks that people use at bars or whatever to make people cluck like a chicken.
Yeah, well, here's what I learned, right? So that, what you're talking about, is what they call stage hypnosis. And this is my own take, right? I'm going to give you my take, having been trained now. So hypnosis is not what makes people better. It's what you do while they're under hypnosis. So I liken it to if you had a gallbladder problem, I could take your gallbladder out without anesthesia, but it would be really painful and you would not like me. Like I'd be cutting into you, right? So anesthesia allows me to do something to you to fix your gallbladder without you being in agony. So to me, hypnosis is that it relaxes you. It turns down the outside world. But the real therapeutic efforts are coming through the neuro-linguistic programming. And that's where you start changing people's mindset. You start changing their perceptions. You start changing their, you reframe it, as was the word they use, right? So you take some memory that they've had that's memory A, and you reframe it to memory A1. And A1 is not attached to the fear reaction. So then they walk out going, yeah, this is good. I don't need this anymore.
Okay.
So it's definitely not that. In fact, I think they should call it something else. Get rid of the word hypnosis, because too many people have that misconception that hypnosis is going to make me bark like a dog. So when I do it with patients, the first thing I say to them, you are always in control. If there's something that I ask you to do that you don't want to do, you just say, no, I'm not doing that. And we will stop. You're going to be in control. You'll know what's going to happen. You're not going to be barking like a dog because I said so. So you're always in control. So do not, don't think that it's just, they're going to try to make you bark like a dog or try to kill somebody when you want to hear a bell. Like, no, that doesn't, it's not how it works.
So I know you've written a book.
Yeah. Tell
me about that.
Yeah. It was called Highway to Your Happy Place, A Roadmap to Less Stress. And it was kind of fascinating. When I started writing the book, the first insights that came to me were on ways to define our stresses and where they come from. And so I had already written 6 or 7 chapters of like how to worry less, how to feel less guilty, how to have better self-esteem, things like that, right? And I was talking to my patient going, hey, I just had this thought, like if you had less stress, where would you be? And they looked at me like, what? No one's ever asked me that. Like, well, no, where would you be? They're like, I don't know. I never got that far. All I ever wanted was less stress, right? So then I started having this idea that, you know what? We need to define what a happy place is, because that's where we want to be, right? I don't want to just be not have stress. I want to be in a happy place. But then when I started reading about happy places, I was like, yeah, we don't have a real good definition of what a happy place is. And if you don't know where you're trying to get to, it's really hard to get there, right? So I came up with this have a happy place to say, hey, look, here's where we're heading. And so when I started defining a happy place, I likened it to a house. So if you go to somebody's house, they're going to have a kitchen, they're going to have a bathroom, they're going to have a living room, they're going to have a bedroom, the closet. So they're going to have the same rooms, but how the house is laid out, how they decorate it, it's all going to be different. So everybody's happy place is going to be different, but they're all going to have the same rooms. And so then it was like, so what rooms are in the happy place? So that's when I came up with these rooms. So to me, the rooms are going to be like, hey, am I contented? Do I have anything pleasurable in my life? Is there anything I can look forward to, anticipating pleasure? Is there anything that I feel grateful for? Hey, do I feel fulfilled? And the last one I call is called CASH. And CASH is an acronym I came up with. Do you have CASH? So it means, am I connected? Am I accepted? Am I appreciated? Do I feel safe? And do I have hope? So when you put all those rooms together, you're like, oh, that's a happy place, right? If you had all those rooms filled up, you'd be like, yeah, life's good, right? So the idea of the book then became, the first part of the book was, hey, let's define a happy place. And now we can figure out ways to get those things. Then the second part of the book was like, wait, like now I know where my happy place is. What's keeping me from getting there? And you're like, oh, right, all those stresses that I'm feeling. And so that was where the other insight that came to me. So as a primary care physician, I'm used to giving people prescriptions and saying, hey, here's the medicine for your blood pressure, your diabetes. It's great medicine, works really well. Oh, but it might have a few side effects. It might make you dizzy. It might make you tired. It might make your mouth dry, blah, 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 whatever. So when I took that concept and I applied it to humans, then I go, oh, wait a second. The majority of human stresses are side effects to our amazing skills. So we have the incredible, unprecedented skill of being able to envision the future. So you and I can talk about what we're going to do next week or next year or 10 years from now. No other animal does that, right? But the side effect is, then I have to worry about it. So here's what I found, that there are humans that aren't able to envision the future. So my one-year-old grandson doesn't envision the future. My 90-year-old demented patient in the nursing home doesn't envision a future. So guess what? They literally can't worry because they don't have that skill. So they don't have the side effect, but they don't have that skill. So their life isn't as successful. So when you look at our stresses as side effects to our skills, then you go, oh, well, now if I understand that worry is actually the side effect of being able to envision a future, then the next question is, well, how do I keep the skill and get rid of the side effect? And that's where the book comes in. So Highway to Your Happy Place, A Roadmap to Less Stress, goes through some of the big stresses that people have, like worry, like guilt. So guilt is, I did something wrong and I feel shame. Regret, which turns out is very different than guilt, though they're similar. Regret is, I made a bad choice and how do I live with that, right? Self-esteem has some very different things that define it. Being overwhelmed, being bored. One of my friends, who's actually a professional, she read the book and she's, wait, I never realized that boredom was that bad. I'm like, no, boredom is bad. Like you see teenagers and they're bored. Oh man, people do lots of weird things to get rid of their boredom, right? But so like the therapist nowadays will say to people, just live for today. And you're like, well, that's a nice thought. First off, no human can live for today. It's not possible because we spend way too much time in the future and in the past. And second off, why would I want to give up my greatest skill of being able to envision the future? I want people to be able to live in all three tenses of their lives, past, present, and future, under their control so they can enjoy themselves and enjoy it all, not just, oh, okay, I got to live right here.
Okay, everyone. Thanks for sticking with us. Before we dive into our next topic, I just want to take a quick moment to remind you to like this video, subscribe to our channel, and hit that notification bell. That way, you'll always be the first to know when a new episode drops. And we want to hear from you. What topics are you most excited about? Drop your thoughts in the comments below. Your feedback helps us create content that you love. We've got some exciting stuff coming your way, so don't miss out. Now, let's switch gears and jump into our next discussion.
So I am talking about tech overwhelm and how to figure out what software you need and what software you don't need. The general rule of thumb, if you are paying a subscription to something and you can't remember the last time you used it, I recommend you stop paying for that service. Just straight off the top, that is the easiest advice I can give you. If you are paying for something monthly, it keeps being seen on that credit card, but you or any and nobody you work with has been in that software for, let's say, 2 months with no plans on being in that software in the next 2 months, stop paying for it. You don't need it. Obviously, you're not using it.
There's a commercial that I've been watching that they, I forget who the vendor is, but they sell you an app that kind of keeps track of the things you're just talking about. Yeah. And so it will do it for you automatically. Do this work? Are they good or not?
I have used Rocket Money and it will tell you how many subscriptions you have with different places. I am not, however, a spokesperson for them. So that is not a paid advertisement. But yeah, I have used them. I still have it on my phone and tend to use it. But at the moment, I'm not paying for it, so it won't cancel any of my extra subscriptions. It just tells me I have them and tells me I need to work on that.
So take your own advice, is that what you're telling?
Pretty much. So Rocket Money and things like that are more made to recognize that, hey, maybe you're paying for three Netflix accounts when you thought you were only paying for one.
Or my stepson's house, and he and his girlfriend are paying for two Hulu accounts and two this and two that's. And you're like, what are you doing here? And this is what I found is most people don't even know they're doing that. Maybe they get two different credit cards. They don't even realize they're both paying for it, or they don't look at their credit card and they just pay the bill. Yeah.
So that's where Rocket Money comes in, because you put all your accounts into the thing and it goes, just so you're aware. You have three Netflix accounts, two Hulus, you have three, you know, this or three that or whatever. And it'll be like, do you want to cancel some of these? Which ones do you want to cancel if you're paying for it? And it will help you if you're paying for it. And it's like $5 a month to make sure your finances are kept in order. They help you categorize your expenses, like at a glance with their little graph thing, what you're spending your money on. So it is very helpful for those who aren't using a different program, because it's just
them. Now with my stepson and his girlfriend, they found a budgeting app and it was like $5. And you're like, but it allowed them to see, because they were spending more than they were making and they were getting into trouble. And you're like, they didn't even realize what they were doing. And you're like, so we sat down and we went down as an emergency visit and said, we need to sit down and make a budget. So after we left, they called us up and go, hey, we want to do this, but it's not in the budget. I was like, yes, it's working.
So the first thing, besides those two things, the first thing you want to do is figure out what software you actually need. So you need something to be able to get email. So you need Gmail or you need Outlook, right? I would recommend, even if it's a company email, sending it through Gmail, because then it is structured the same way as everybody else. You have a Google Drive folder for your team, that kind of thing. Outlook is one of those things where when it works okay, but when it's screwing up and bottlenecking, it's a pain in the neck to even try to figure out. And a lot of people don't have the tech skills to get that figured out, where I don't think I've ever had a problem with Gmail not working correctly. If you are in business for yourself, you need a CRM, a customer relationship thing. What does the CRM stand for again? Customer relations something. I don't remember. Anyway, besides the point, you still need one. basically that gives you your the way to send out newsletters, the way to keep all your contacts in one place. I use Go High Level.
Customer relationship management.
There you go. Customer relationship management. I knew I was saying parts of it right, but I was like, I'm doing something wrong. I use Go High Level because it allows me to have the, obviously, all my contacts can be in there as people I can email, whether I've got a lead going in there or not. It also hosts my website. I can do, there's a social media calendar in there if you don't use another one. Go High Level has pretty much everything you need right in it. And most prices for the small package is not that big. And it groups everything together. So you're not paying for this thing, that thing, or the opposite thing. You're just paying in one place. Then you have to figure out with your company or having a conversation with somebody who can help with that. There are a lot of places where you can get lifetime deals. My calendaring system, I paid for it once, and it's a lifetime deal. I don't have to pay for it again. So if you're paying monthly or yearly for Calendly, maybe it's time to take the time to switch. Go to AppSumo and get one of their lifetime deals for a calendar software. Because I know that I, 2 years ago, was paying over $300 a year for Calendly. And then I got TidyCal, which was like $39 on AppSumo. And I'm not paying all that money anymore. I've already paid that one-time fee. I don't ever have to pay for it again. And it works. That's how you got here. It sends out the email 24 hours ahead of time and an hour ahead of time. It makes sure people know when they're supposed to be at the appointment that they've scheduled. It also will put it on your calendar if you have one that you use. Some softwares have a 14-day trial. If you can't manage to work in one software like 3 or 4 times in that 14-day trial, that's not something you need to buy. Because you're not going to use it. Why buy something you're not going to use? It's a waste of your time and resources. Because when you get a new program, you have to set it up. And if you have the 14-day thing and you're not setting it up, you're not spending time in that thing, why do you have it? Why do you think you need it?
Yeah, I just went through this myself. I had 2 apps that gave you synopsis of books. They would give you like a 15-minute synopsis of the book. I'm like, oh, I need that, right? Because I want to read a lot of books, but I don't have time to read the whole book. Yeah, so I had signed up for 2 different ones, and I don't think I ever read more than one in either one, like in a year. So yeah, my wife came to me because she's good at this stuff. She's like, hey, this is on your credit card. Why do you have this? I'm like, oh yeah, I should just cancel that. And the problem was, those were once a year charges. So the problem is, like, once a month I would have picked up, but once a year, you're like, oh, right? So yeah, so it came through the once a year. I'm like, oh yeah, I got to get rid of these because just like you said, I haven't used this. Good idea, but I haven't used it, so this has to go away.
Yeah, if you buy it and forget about it, why did you buy it?
Yeah, exactly.
What was your thought process going into that? So the biggest thing I can say is to point out the fact that if you want less stress in your life, spending money on things you don't need to be spending money on is not exactly the way to have less stress.
Absolutely. Because all those things take energy. You're right. You said this. I use the word resources, but same idea, right? That's when I was down with my stepson and his girlfriend. I'm like, you understand that you only have a finite amount of resources, money, time, energy, and you're using it all these different things. It's just spread out. They have all these pets. They have all these different animals. They have all these different softwares. They have all, and you're like, even if it's just a little thing, $30 a month, $20 a month, $10 a month, like that's $10 that you can't use over here. And it's like, when you add up 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, all of a sudden it's like, yeah, this is my wife's big line, is that it becomes a leak, and the leak takes energy and time.
It also drains resources over time, because if you don't plug it up, you're constantly throwing money at a situation that is just going to keep hemorrhaging that money.
You're not my wife, are you?
No, okay. I am not.
That's exactly the same thing she says.
So one of the things that I do is I help people with their tech. So if somebody doesn't know how to use a certain software, or they think that computers were made of the devil and they don't know how to use them, different barriers for different people. But I can usually help them to get familiar enough with their computer that they're not scared of it and that they can use some of their software. But for somebody like that, I don't recommend they get a whole bunch of stuff. I do recommend you update your email if you have an AOL email or a Hotmail or a Yahoo email. Like, nobody uses those anymore. And you're showing your age in your email, and that might close doors for you. So either a branded account or a Gmail account is way better, for at least in business, because a lot of people will look at somebody with an AOL account and go, oh, they're like 90. I'm not talking to them. I can safely say that if I had an AOL account, I do not remember it anymore. My Hotmail and my Yahoo were connected to each other to be the emergency contact for each other, and they will forever be lost to me because they were the contact for each other and I lost the passwords. So if you are looking for new software and you yourself are not somebody who is very tech savvy, either find a friend who is tech savvy or come talk to me. Because going into looking for software, not knowing what you need, not knowing why you need it, and not knowing how much you're willing to spend on anything, you're going to get taken advantage of.
Or not get what you need.
Or, which means you got taken advantage of. Mm. Because you have a software, sure, but maybe it does this tiny C thing that you needed, maybe, but not the big things that you needed. So it's like not even something usable for your company. It is never easy to figure out after the fact that you done messed up.
I just went through this. I had hired a company to help build a better website for me. And they built this beautiful website. And I said, yeah, but I already have my name, right? It's lessstressdoc.com. So I want whatever you just built put onto my... under that name. And they're like, oh, well, we can do that, but then none of the functions that we build into this will work. And you're like, wait, what? It's like, okay. So yeah, there I got taken advantage of.
And that's the other thing. You want to read any contracts that you're given from somebody where you're getting a website build. If they've given you something in writing and you're not reading it to make sure that, yeah, I can, or raise the question that says, hey, I need this to be able to be used on with my domain name. What do I have to do to make sure that happens?
Well, I'd asked all those questions of the salesman who was like, oh, yeah, it'll be fine. And then, of course, when I got to the tech person, he was like, yeah, we can't do that.
That sometimes happens. And if you have somebody testing and talking to the people, you might come across that faster and without signing anything. Mm. I have been able to get on with tech before signing the contract and finding out this stuff isn't what the salesperson is saying.
Mm-hmm.
But I've also been taken advantage of where a company, I won't name names, said that they could do a whole bunch of things the same as a different software we were using in the roofing community. And they could not in any sense of the word. And we didn't find out until we were trying to import everything. And then the company ended up having to move back to the other software. So it does happen.
Yep.
But the sooner you find that out, the less money you're spending.
Yes, that's exactly what happened. So it didn't take long before I realized they weren't going to be able to do what they want. And so I ended up going to somebody. And I use somebody local. I don't know if you make a difference in that, but given that I'm old school, like, I still like being able to talk to somebody, call them up on the phone, because a lot of these places will only communicate you through email. And there's nuances to your questions and your problems that are hard to communicate in emails.
I work with people all over the U.S. I will get on the phone. I will start a Zoom call. I will email.
Yeah, that makes a difference to me. I don't know if that's the way other people are, but.
Yeah, it depends on the person, how they've decided to set up their business. And that's to their detriment.
I still think humans want to have that communication. Even if it's by Zoom, that's better than through email, right?
Yeah. So the last thing to consider when you're looking at different things is a lot of stuff nowadays has a base price. So you can pay $5 a month, I think it is, for Hulu, and you get Hulu. But you get Hulu with commercials, right? You have to pay the $10 or $15 a month in order to not get commercials. And I'm telling you now, you put a commercial in anything I'm watching, I'm skipping it. I'm not watching commercials. I don't like commercials. Not happening. Ads, whatever they call them now. Now I sound like an old person. So for me, when I was looking at Hulu, it was, and I saw that, I was like, oh no, well then I'm going to have to pay the higher price because I don't want commercials. I don't want the ads. I did the same thing for YouTube and the same thing for my Pandora. As soon as somebody was like, oh yeah, you can listen and watch this for free, but we're going to stick ads in every 5 minutes. And I went, no, you're not. Here's some money. Don't do that to me. Now the only ones I get are the ones that the creators themselves are talking about. And if I've heard it for a thousandth time, I might skip over it. But know what you are getting in the base package and what things are add-ons after it. So like MailChimp is free for the first 500 contacts. And then every 100 or I don't know how many the groupings are, but every so many contacts, the price goes up. And then if you want to add texting to that, it goes up. That's a separate cost. And those go up with however many contacts you have. So in MailChimp, you could end up paying hundreds of dollars a month just because you have a lot of contacts and a lot of people you're being able to text because they've given you that permission. Whereas if you put that on Go High Level, your list, in my case anyway, your list of contacts can be as big as you want, and they're not going to charge you for that. And then there is always a price for texting because they want to make sure that you're doing it legally, which means you're paying for it. But it's a lesser charge than a lot of other places. So the biggest piece of advice I can give anybody looking for any kind of new software is to pay attention to what you're getting. And if you can do a free trial, do the free trial and see if you actually use it after the first time you do something in it. And then hurry up and cancel at the end of that, before the end of the thing, so that you don't get snagged. If you're doing free trials, put your absolute last day to cancel on a calendar so that it reminds you that you have a trial. Otherwise, Rocket Money might tell you 6 months from now that you're paying for that subscription still. So this turned into one great big ad for Rocket Money. Yeah, I hope they appreciate that.
You came up with that. I did not.
You came up with it and didn't know the name. I said the name.
That's right.
So do you have anything to add here at the end?
One thing I leave out for people at the end is to say, look, lots of us are stressed out. Some of us are overwhelmed. And they get to some point where they think it's never going to change. It's always going to be like this. And what I say to people is don't resign yourself to being stressed out the rest of your life. It does not have to be like that. There are ways to reduce your stress. Get my book, Highway to Happy Place, Roadmap to Less Stress. Go read somebody else's book. Go to counseling, whatever. It doesn't have to be you're stressed out the rest of your life. There's ways to get rid of it.
Okay. Thank you very much for coming.